Welcome to the Let Good Things In show. I'm your host, Amanda Acker. I am so happy you are here. At the Let Good Things In show, we talk all about second chances, resiliency, following your intuition, and even music. Listen to hear stories of hope and to be inspired. Remember, you are stronger than you think. Let's dive in. Hi, my amazing humans. Thank you so much for tuning in to yet again another episode of the Let Good Things In show. I'm so, so grateful for you, and I would love to hear from you. Whether you have a suggestion or a comment, or even if you are thinking about being a guest on the show, send me an email, amanda@amandaacker.com. Acker is spelled A-C-K-E-R. And if you're loving the show, head on over to Apple Podcasts and leave me a review so more people can find the show. So this interview, I'm so excited to release it. It's been a long time in the making, and this man that I interviewed just amazes me in so many ways, and I'm so excited to dive in. But a couple of things about this episode. So number one, it had to happen in two sessions because my internet decided to go completely haywire. So it is a little bit pieced together, but I assure you that it sounds great. And my husband is such a great editor, so it's still going to be amazing. So I'm excited. And, you know, April is Second Chances Month. And since I'm releasing this episode on the last day of April, this is the perfect episode to end out Second Chances Month, because this man that I interviewed, or had a conversation with, rather, was incarcerated for a long time. And his story is extremely inspirational. So I am so excited. So let me start with his bio. I interviewed Quan Nguyen. Quan has been described as a mighty warrior, a magician, and a mountain of goodness. He is the best-selling author of Sparrow in the Razor Wire, Finding Freedom from Within While Serving a Life Sentence. His book was written for men that are doing long or life-term sentences, and in it, he shares how he found his freedom years before he was ever even paroled. He works as the senior post-release program manager for Defy Ventures, a nonprofit helping those with a criminal past transform their lives through the journey of entrepreneurship. After spending 22 years in and out of correctional institutions, Quan was paroled from a life sentence in 2015 and created his first company 6 months later. The following year, he received the Peace Fellowship Award for his work with the Alternatives to Violence Project. Quan has been featured in Entrepreneur, PBS NewsHour, Talks at Google, and numerous other publications and podcasts. Quan is an amazing human, and he's so kind and so open to share his story. I'm so grateful that he chose to be a guest on the show. So without further ado, let's dive in. Hi, Quan. Welcome to the show. So happy to have you here.
Hi, Amanda. I'm happy to be here.
So I just want to start our conversation just like by asking you, you know, a little bit about your story and what led you to be where you are today.
Sure. Where would you like me to start?
Well, I read your entire book, so I know pretty much the whole story. But I wanted you to touch on, you know, what first let's talk about what was it like growing up? Like, where did you grow up and okay. How was that for you?
Yeah, I grew up in Provo, Utah. I'm a first generation Vietnamese immigrant. We came to the United States right after we lost our country in Vietnam. So I was only several months old, and I grew up in Provo, Utah. My father had come to the U.S. to train with the American forces, so he knew what the country, the lay of the land of the country was. My mother had never seen snow.
Oh, wow.
So that's why they decided Provo, Utah, of all places.
Awesome. Yeah. And in your book, you talked about, you know, the racism that was, you know, you were put into as a young child, and how, you know, you were the oldest, correct? You were the older brother.
Yes.
And so
I was the oldest, yeah.
You witnessed something, I believe, like when you and your brother were out somewhere and your brother got beat up, correct? And then you felt like your dad made you feel as though like you should have protected him. So what transpired from that? Like, how did that make you feel going forward? And how old were you when that happened?
I think as a little boy, I experienced quite a bit of racism, but I didn't know what that was. I just always felt, like, why are these people teasing or saying stuff or mocking us or looking or pointing at us? I remember growing up just wishing, like, why can't I look normal like all the kids at school? Why can't my family look normal? Or just never really feeling like we fit in. And the incident that you're referring to, it was my younger brother and I playing with our G.I. Joes in the streams. We used to play this game where we'd make rafts with our popsicle sticks and we tied it together and we put our G.I. Joes and let them float down the stream and just follow it. And some older kids and some adults started throwing rocks down at us and told us, like, get out of our country, things like that. And of course, being like little kids and thinking like the fence is so big and, you know, there's no way they can get us.
Yeah.
We told them, oh, come and make us. And those kids hopped the fence and chased us down. I had dropped my G.I. Joes and my younger brothers just stopped to pick it up and face the kids. And of course, you know, they punched him and shoved him down and just started throwing dirt in his mouth. And I stood there. I didn't dare to do anything. I was just terrified.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was around eight, my brother's six. And when we got home, my dad was, when he found out, he's like, how did you let this happen to your younger brother? So I'm not sure, you know, what his intent, like, of course, he's just frustrated and like, how did this happen? And you're supposed to protect your family at all costs. But for me, I just felt like very ashamed.
Yeah.
I let down my family, let down my brother, let down my dad. And I remember growing up after that, my brother and I were like overly sensitive to anyone even harming us. So he'd fly into a rage when someone would just get near me or threaten me in some way and vice versa. So I think from there, I was already instilled in me, like, I never want to let down my family or let down my brother, let anything happen to him.
Yeah.
So it was just like, went to the other extreme of just protecting him.
So what was your relationship like with your father?
Oh, my father was my hero. So when he came to the U.S., his first job was as a janitor at a supermarket. This is what I know from what my you know, just from family talking about, my mom telling me. And then the first vehicle he bought was a bike so he'd get to work faster. So he worked as a janitor. And then he later on created the Vietnamese Refugee Association to help other Vietnamese refugees adjust to our new homeland. So he would drive on like Saturday mornings to like neighboring states to help other families that didn't know how to fill out the paperwork for their social security documents or their DMV.
Wow.
So that's all he was doing, was just helping Vietnamese refugees. And I got to go with him on these things. And he used to tell me, like, this is his job. And I, you know, I was a little boy, like, oh, how much do you get paid? He said, I don't get paid for this. And that didn't make any sense to me.
Yeah.
And then as a boy, I'm thinking, like, this is so boring. But I enjoyed being in the car rides with my father. So I was the one that got to take these long car rides with him on a Saturday morning. We get home late on Saturday evenings, and he was helping people. That's what his weekend was dedicated to. Like, later on, he was working in the coal mines there, but on the weekends, that's what he would do. And I used to get to accompany him. So because of his work, he got recognized and was on the news quite often. Like, people would come to our house and government officials and stuff like that. And so I see him on TV. So it just made my father even more superhuman in my eyes.
And then I know something tragic happens with your father. So, you know, I know in the book you said that you eventually moved to California when your father got sick. So what was that like for you? Like, seeing your superhero father fall ill and no longer be able to do those things?
He gets diagnosed with leukemia, which I didn't know what that was. They just said it's a cancer.
Yeah.
And they said, his condition, like, he started going in and out of the hospital, and then his condition started to get worse. So I guess that's when he decided he wanted to get closer to his family that had settled out in California. So I think when I was 10 is when we resettled out to California. Of course, I was scared, but because of hearing that he has cancer, that he might possibly die. But of course, as a boy, I'm like, no, my dad is superhuman. He's going to be okay.
Right.
We moved out here to California, and this is the first time that I'm going to school with like other kids of color, because in Utah it's all 99% white and 99% Mormon, and we were like Vietnamese and Roman Catholic.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, going to school over here in California was also a shock for me, because there were all these different races. It was very diverse, but then I remember some Vietnamese kids started teasing me because they said I was whitewashed because I couldn't speak Vietnamese well.
Oh, geez.
So I think that also contributed to a lot of my issues of not feeling like I fit in, and my acceptance issues that I struggled with for a long time, even into my adult years. But that's where a lot of that began for me.
Okay.
And my father's condition, I think it took a turn for the worse, like close to about like when I was around 13. And the doctors had said that my mom told us that the doctor said that he was going to die. Mm. Of course, I think because we are, as a little boy, my understanding of my faith is like, okay, well, I'm just going to pray and things are going to be fine. And our first communion was coming up. So having conversations with my brother and sister now, like I think all of us would be like, okay, they said dad's going to die, but we are all having our first communion soon and we get to pray. And that first prayer is we're all going to pray for dad to live. So the morning of our first communion, I remember stepping into the bathroom and my little sister peeks her head out from the shower curtain and says like, dad died last night. And I said, how'd you know? She said, I overheard mom and grandma talking about it, but we're not supposed to know. And, you know, and it was, I didn't realize how bizarre that whole scene was of going to church and pretending that we didn't know my father was dead until I, you know, had to go back and explore and write and begin writing about this experience in my book and just remembering. And then just how it became like, wow, this was such a bizarre day. We're all in church. The priest is talking how this is a joyous occasion and we're all celebrating. But yet me, my brother and sister all know my dad is dead. And yet we still have to pretend that he's alive to put on this front for my mom and grandma, or for some reason thinking we have to just be here and be happy. And then, yeah, it's very bizarre, but
I couldn't imagine.
We leave mass. Yeah. I remember my younger sister threw up outside the church when we left after eating the bread. And it's like, you know, thinking, okay, wait, I can't somehow I'm a bad kid or somehow something's wrong because God killed my father because so that he would have to grant this prayer for me.
Wow.
So there's all these things that I think all of us had to process. Like, I mean, at that age, like when I look now, like we should have definitely went to therapy. But at that time, it's like no one ever asked us, how are you feeling? Or okay, do you want to talk about this? Let's process this. It's more, like I remember at the funeral, my father's friend from the military said, you're such a brave kid because you're not even crying. Like somehow it's weak to cry. And I think, if I should let them know that I'm going to cry, then that means I'm weak. So I have to be strong like my father was, and thinking that's how, you know, men are supposed to be.
Yeah, you know, that had to have been so hard as a child to experience something so tragic. Like you looked up to your father, you know, you had a strong bond with him. And yeah, like you said, you saw him as like a superhero, you know, so to have to go through that and then to not feel like it was okay to cry, that somehow you were doing something wrong if you showed emotion, you know, that I couldn't imagine going through something like that at such a young age and then not being able to fully express myself and how I was feeling, you know, and feeling like, so when your father passed, like, what did that do for, you know, you moving forward? Like, did you ever, you know, mourn his death, or did you kind of just go through the motions and start to go down the path that you ultimately went down? Was it a quick transition, or did it take time for you to get there?
Well, I mean, I would say I did not begin to mourn his death until like 25 years later.
Wow.
So I think it's just like, I just went through life, kind of numb and, you know, put my head down, like, okay, not talk about it. Not be about the weird kid in school that suddenly doesn't have a father, sticking out more, you know?
Yeah.
But then, getting mixed up with, other kids in the neighborhood that were also, you know, like, I wouldn't say bad kids, but like, we're just kids that are just like, I don't know how to describe it. Like just kids that start running on the streets already. And of course then becomes worse. Like, you know, like, what was it? First sentence in, chapter 2 of my book, I was not born a murderer. And it was just like, okay, I just didn't suddenly flip over the script and become a bad person. It was just, okay, I was just lost. I was misguided. And I began going down this path of running on the streets. And this actually alleviated some of my feelings of not being accepted, because now I have certain friends. And yes, even if certain friends are running on the streets and breaking into cars, well, this is what we do, and it becomes normalized. And I think, okay, this is a criminal element that's exciting for me, and I think it was a way for me to just feel like I belong somewhere.
Yeah, you know, that's
so. Yeah, I think.
Sorry, I'm sorry. I mean to cut you off, but you know, because you felt like, because you were searching for that acceptance, you know, I mean, all kids are searching for some sort of acceptance, especially at, and when you're a teenager, you know, it's very important for us to find our place. And, you know, it's unfortunate that that's where you ended up finding your place. But at the same time, that gave you some sort of feeling of, I don't want to say power, maybe that is the right word, but you felt like you were included, you know, so when did the criminal activity start? Like, what was the first time, you know, because I know you were incarcerated a few times. So what, that first experience, like, what happened?
Well, the first incarceration would not be inclusive of my first criminal experience. I mean, let me, maybe 13 or 14. I was with one of my friends when he broke into a car for the first time. Mm-hmm. His older brothers drove us, and then just seeing that, like, we're in the, out at night and going in the car, and just that excitement, but then also like, oh, we're not supposed to do this, but yet there was a sense of excitement. So and then I think, how old was I, the first time that I had, one of my friends had told me to get this briefcase from his home because the police were coming to raid them. So I brought the briefcase up to my house, and they were living in the same apartments. And I saw the police raid their home, and they brought him out and there was nothing. So I was like, oh, what is in this suitcase?
Right.
So I was like, what is this? So it was the one with like the lock combinations. Yeah. There's three digits. So I started trying to figure it out, like 000001. And I finally got it open, and inside were a bunch of counterfeit payroll checks. And I saw a gun. So I was like, oh, look at this. And so I picked up the gun, and I remember like feeling like what you're talking about, that sense of power. Like, yeah. Wow, this is so cool. This is a gun. And I know what they did with these payroll checks. I go, oh yeah, I know what they were doing. Like, they used to have us go drop some of this stuff off at the banks and just put, use this as the pull cash out and things like that. Oh. So I'm like, oh, okay. So I kind of was involved with that. Just seeing that and being exposed to it and thinking, okay, this is normal. This is what we do. And my first arrest was at 17. It was when my younger brother had come to my work. I was working at a Subway sandwich And I was, one of the people that make the Subway sandwiches. And my younger brother comes in and said that some other kids from like a continuation high school nearby to the same high school we went to had called and threatened to kill my family.
Oh, geez.
These were kids that proclaimed to be like skinheads or like Nazis or stuff like that.
Yeah.
So we already didn't get along with them like that. And we'd already had a couple of run-ins with them. I think previous to that, one of my friends at a party, when we were at a party, we were outnumbered and he had pulled that his gun out. One of my friends had a 22 caliber gun that he carried everywhere with him. And it was at a party that we got surrounded. He pulled the gun out and everyone ran. And I just remember feeling like, oh, wow, this is so powerful.
Yeah.
This is so cool for our group to have this thing. This is like the best equalizer of them all. So then everything we just talked about, oh, well, we'll just shoot this up. We'll shoot that up. So that night when my brother came, he said, that the skinheads had called to threaten our mom. And if I knew where they lived, and I said, no. So I asked my coworker. She's like, oh, I think this is where they live. So she drew like a very crude map, like, oh, this is the streets and stuff. And my brother and my friend said, okay, we'll come back to pick you up at 10 o'clock and we'll find your house and we'll shoot it up.
Yes.
And of course I was, So like we all started talking about this. None knowing that well, none of us had ever shot a gun before. We had never done anything like this. So I guess my brother and my friends left. They went to an arcade that we always used to go and play our video games. And I guess when they were there, they ran into an older kid that knew where these guys lived. So this older kid, like, here, I'll take you guys there. They went there and my friend ended up going up to the house, knocking on the door. They opened the door and he ran inside and shot three people.
Oh, goodness.
Luckily, they all survived. But within a couple of weeks, they arrested. I remember I came home that night and my brother, because 10 o'clock I get off, nobody came to pick me up. So I went home. My younger brother was laid in bed, terrified. I said, what happened? He's like, oh, they ran up in the house and they shot them. Look, and we looked out. We saw the helicopters flying around. So my brother was like, he was terrified. I was terrified. And then within a couple of weeks, they came to arrest my brother and I. They arrested me for a conspiracy to commit murder. So at 17, my brother was 15. We were facing 45 years to life. For that,
Oh, my gosh. Well, how did they even... Like, my question around that story is, like, but you weren't there. You know, obviously you conspired, but, you know, because you talked about it with these other friends of yours, but why would they sentence you for so long when you weren't even there? You didn't commit the actual crime.
Well, I mean, my understanding now is because those conspiracy laws were a result of the war on drugs, like the mass incarceration policies of the 80s and 90s. So these laws came out where they could just grab people up, and it was so. I was arrested under this conspiracy, this penal called conspiracy. I think it's 186.2 that came out in California. So they were able to arrest me under that, and it's because during that war on drugs, they wanted to be able to grab as many people as possible under very loose sounding legalities, and the conspiracy charge was one of those. I mean, like, they grabbed me, but they didn't grab the person that drew the map.
That's what I was going to ask. Like, what? Yeah, that doesn't make any sense. Like, she was obviously also conspiring because she literally was trying to help you guys find these other boys. And what happened to the guys who actually shot up that house?
The guy who shot up the house got the same amount of time as me. We ended up getting 7 years in the California Youth Authority. The person that drove the car, that showed him where the house, only got 5 years. The person that showed the house was not a person of color. And the person that drew the map was not a person of color. So there was a whole bunch of stuff like that. You know, but
wow, that's I couldn't, you know, like, that's just another thing. Like, I, you know, as I was reading your book, you know, and I'm sitting here and I'm going, wow, like, I couldn't imagine that. But at the same time, like, you know, before you got arrested, and just like the idea of like the conspiracy, like I could understand why that would be almost exciting in a way. Like, oh, you know, like we have this gun, like, so that gives us some sort of authority, and that rush of like getting away with something, you know, and having these things that you know you're not supposed to have, you know, and when you're that young, that you're very impressionable. So if that's what you're exposed to, and that's what you think is going to give you popularity, acceptance, whatever it is you're searching for, you know, that's a high in itself, even without the use of substances, you know, like that's an intense emotion. That's an intense feeling. And if you like that feeling, you're going to chase that feeling, you know? Mm-hmm. So after you're in the juvenile center, I know you didn't spend the whole 7 years in there, correct?
No, I think I did about 2 years, 2.5 years. Okay. They paroled me after that. But now I'm branded as a convicted felon. Came home and I felt very out of place.
Yeah.
I remember my friends from high school were gone, or the ones that I ran into were like, oh, he was in jail, or, you know, and I felt like, man, I was in jail. They don't understand. Plus, I also had my experience of what happened to me during those 2 years while incarcerated, how I got very involved with the gang element inside the jails, and just the thinking of, you know, different races. And so a lot of the guys that I was incarcerated with throughout juvenile hall and the jails and the California Youth Authority later on became the core part of the gang that we formed.
Mm.
So that was like, I come home lost and confused still. So I, of course, enrolled back in college and go, this is, at least I'll enroll in college and just try to get jobs.
Yeah.
But I kept on getting turned down because of that I was a convicted felon. And they found out about it later and just fired me. And then there was a part of me that was still very attracted to the gang life, because at least here's a place where people can accept me and just be okay with me.
Yeah, so like you were... You know, it's hard to, I know, like, I'm a convicted felon, and I know, like, when you get out, it's like, I describe it as, like, you feel like not only do you have that mark, you feel like everybody knows, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, like, if you're surrounded by other people who haven't experienced it, you feel like an outsider, like, no matter if they know or they don't know, you still feel that internally. So, of course, you're going to gravitate towards those who get it. You know, they know what that's like. They're also felons, or at least they've been involved in crime in some way. So you feel like that's where you belong.
Sorry, we are experiencing technical difficulties, and the show will resume in 3, 2, 1.
So, Quan, could you tell us, you know, what happened that led you to be incarcerated for you know, your life sentence?
Yes. So on January 15th, 1999, I shot and killed a man by the name of Min Nguyen and tried to shoot and kill three other men that were in the car with him. I was tried for the death penalty. But because I lied at trial, I coached witnesses, and I had already got rid of evidence. I was found guilty of second-degree murder and sentenced to 15 years to life in the California prison system. At the time, for me, a life sentence, regardless in the state of California, was the same thing as a death sentence, because they had not paroled one single life-term prisoner since 1977. And I knew that.
Oh,
so
my goodness.
I knew, okay, I have a life sentence, and I'm going to die in here. Because 15 to life, 50 to life, 5 to life, nobody was paroling from California at that time. And that's the mindset I went up. So I'm going to live the way I want. And that's basically, I continued with living the way I wanted in prison. Because now, like, okay, what are they going to do? Nothing. So
right.
Yeah, so I just lived the way I wanted for about 10, 11 years of my sentence. There was no sense of remorse, no sense of self-reflection or understanding. It was basically, okay, the reason why I'm in prison is because of them. They told on me, or because they were in a gang too. And I made all these excuses of why I was in prison. And there was never any sense of personal responsibility in it. Like, wait, you know, like, oh, I killed somebody, but I didn't look at it like that. It was more like, no, it was my life or theirs. All these ways to justify it.
So what happened that made you kind of, because, you know, obviously you got out. So what made you have that transition from thinking, you know, having no remorse to now you are taking ownership for what you did? And all of, how did that transpire?
Yes. So around 2010, 2011, right around that time, several things happened. I got news that my grandfather had passed away, which was my father's father. So that took me back to like just thinking about my father, how did I end up here? Am I supposed to die in here now? Like how, like what my father did during his time on earth and his, 38 years on earth. And I contrasted that with me. I think I was like 35 at the time or something. I can't remember. It's around that same age that my father had passed away. And I started thinking like, how did my dad make such an impact in the world and leave, like, you know, I remember his funeral and how many people showed up at that word that he had impacted during his brief time on earth. And then I thought about my own life and like, I'm going to die. Who's going to show up to my funeral? You know, things like that, questions like that. I also got I remember my brother, had a daughter and I remember seeing her picture for the first time and a baby picture. And she looked exactly like my younger brother. It's just in the form of a girl. I saw the same features and it just took me back to my childhood. Like, how did my life end up like this? Around one thing that's always given me escape is books. So I've been a bookworm my whole life, especially in prison. And that's how I got my escape. And I had this tendency when I read, I go down rabbit trails about this topic or that. And my at the time, I can't remember what book I was reading, but then somehow I stumbled upon books of the saint. And in particular, stories about saints that had failed in some way or another, yet had gone on to build these legacies and create these orders for the church. And I became very fascinated with that. And of course, that leads me down other rabbit trails of spirituality, mindfulness, and my mind becomes expanded. And then, so like all these became like the perfect storm in my head. And it was one day on the prison yard, I was standing by the fence and I said, why do I have to view prison as punishment? Why can't this be a place I could remake myself? Regardless if I'm going to die in here, I have a choice in this. And of course, the answer comes back from the universe. Like, yeah, I do have a choice. I choose to look at this one way or another. And that made all the difference in the world. I remember that sun was coming up over the hills that morning and I could feel the warmth. In the individual blades of grass, I could see the tiny drops of dew. And up above me in the razor wire, I heard a sparrow chirping. And, you know, I tell everyone that the sparrow had probably been chirping my whole prison term. I never heard it. But that day, I heard it. And from that day, like, prison was no longer this cold, harsh, ugly place. It became a place where I felt I could connect to other human beings. Some of them much further along than me. Some of them perhaps not even awakened. I go, man, this is just a journey. And we're just here temporarily. And I just looked at that. That's how I started to view prison life. So, of course, I get also, by this time, this new fascination with personal development and what do I want to do and become, how do I become a better person? One of the first things I did was I checked in with a therapist and, you know what, 25 years later, began to grieve my father's death for the first time. And begin that process of mourning. And of course, being the bookworm, I decide that I want to find out more about the grief and loss process. So I go down another rabbit trail and become very fascinated with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's model on grief and loss and mourning. And looking around me, I noticed men did not have a way to mourn or to grieve, whether that's grieving from family members that have passed away, whether that's grieving because they've been transferred to uprooted from one prison to another and they have to leave friends that they've known for years behind. Grieving or mourning this sense of loss because family members have moved on or are no longer writing them or no longer in contact with them. Grieving or mourning just their the aging process. No one could really properly mourn because in prison you have to put up this facade and you have to be strong and tough. So I put together a syllabus and submitted it to the prison psychologist for the grief and loss, a grief and loss group, and he loved it. We then launched the prison's first ever grief and loss group, and suddenly that building that and being involved with that made me feel like, oh my goodness, I feel alive for once. I can give back. And then I began this process for me where, what else can I be involved with? What other groups can I join? What other groups can I create? And began reading books on facilitating groups and how to group dynamics and all these other things to be involved with. And next thing I know, I look back over the course of several years and I have been involved with so many groups and creating groups and just being involved with them. And then I, you know, and the process I would do is also, of course, being the bookworm and wanting to be a better person, writing to in my journal each night, what did I do right today that I could acknowledge? Where did I stumble or where did I fall short? And replaying in my mind the places where I fell short and how can I fix this for tomorrow? Let's say I want to practice communicating effectively or communicating in kindness, but yet someone says something that I allow to trigger me and then I go off or I say something stupid or I even say it in my mind, but then remembering that and telling myself, okay, how could I respond better next time this happens? So then prison was not even a place where I'm locked in and people are making me mad or anything like that. It's became a place where I can become a human being, a better human being. And these are opportunities. These are things that I can continue to practice each day in this fishbowl of these concepts that I want to become a better person in. And it just changed the whole fabric of me living in there. Yes, I was incarcerated, but by that time I was totally and absolutely free. It just felt like I am just here to become a better soul. And I get to refine it every day. So I am actually more blessed than a lot of people out on the streets. And that's just how I approached life. In 2015, I went to the parole board, expressed how I felt, of how I saw things, share with them the groups I'd created, owned and took full responsibility for all my actions leading up to that point. And they found me suitable. They said, we feel you are no longer a threat to society. And that's when I was paroled in November of 2015. Yeah.
What did that feel like to, when you went in, you said getting paroled wasn't really a thing that was heard of for people with life sentences. So what did that, I know it's probably really hard to explain, but if you could try to, how would you describe how that felt to hear those words? Like, was it, because I know when I got out. Yeah. When I got out, I was only in for 8 months, so it's not really that much comparable. But I remember that feeling of holy shit, I'm free, but I couldn't imagine, having to go to the parole board and do all those things that you had to do to regain your freedom. So how would you just depict that
emotion? To hear them say, we feel you are no longer a threat to society, is probably the most affirming thing I could hear at that time. It's almost like we accept you back into society. We're here as gatekeepers and we feel safe to allow you to rejoin our community. That's basically what their words felt like to me. I was totally surprised. I remember I was having what I thought was a terrible hearing. I thought, no way is the commissioner going to grant me parole because she despises me. And for to hear her say, we find that you are no longer a threat to society. It was, one of the best words I've ever heard.
I bet it was, And then how was the experience, because then you had to go, because I know you said in your book, you had to wait a while to actually get out. Mm-hmm. So what was it like, in that moment? Because I know you've probably created some close relationships with other men that were still, you're going to have to leave them behind. Yeah. So how was that?
That was because it's in the California prison system. It's 150 days while they go through the paperwork, make sure it passes the governor's review desk. And I looked at it as, this is my last 150 days, basically, to be alive with these men. So I wanted to be present with these men. So I was very intentional about spending time instead of like, oh, okay, I'm not here anymore, checked out. But like, I wanted to be present with each of the men that I was going to basically leave behind. So I began, I knew that. So I had to take care of myself. And I actually began my grieving process with them before I left them so that I wouldn't look back on it with regret later. So, in a weird sense, I'm glad I had those 150 days to mourn the loss of their friendships before I left, because, you know, some of them I may never see again.
Right. Do you still talk to any of them? Do you still
I still keep in touch with several. We've lost contact. By the time I paroled, there were some court rulings that came down, so it wasn't unheard of, but I think it was, I can't remember the exact percentages, but it was way less than 5%, I would imagine, at the time, of anyone getting paroled. And most of the men that I saw getting paroled around me were in their 60s, had probably done 30-something years of a life sentence already before they were paroled. So I was able to parole at my 16th year. But since then, they have started to parole more, not as much as they should, but at least they've started parole more. I think those numbers is about 20 to 30% now of lifers that go up.
Oh, wow.
So it's a lot more, but I think it's, the needle still needs to move in the other way.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So, you know, once you were released, like what, you know, I'm sure the outside world had probably changed drastically since you were in the outside world. So what was that like?
I remember the first night out, or even the first week out, it was very hard for me to sleep because it was way too quiet. That I did not hear the regular noises that I used to hear in prison of the officers walking in the keys changing, the boots stomping on the ground, men shuffling in their slippers to go to the toilet, the flush of a toilet in the middle of the night, some men in hushed whispers just that are still up late talking. Those are just background noises that I was very used to, and to come home and there was none of that. It's just absolute silence. It felt very eerie to me. I wasn't used to it. So I remember, I can't sleep. Well, I'm home. I'm so excited. And it's like 3-4 in the morning. So let me just see what's on TV, trying to figure out how to work the remote control. And then when it comes on, seeing the channels, and there's hundreds of channels, and I don't know how to, I go, can I just find ABC or PBS or something?
Right.
And there's all these channels that I don't know how to get anywhere. And I remember that early that morning, coffee, trying to look through all the drawers for coffee. But they have a coffee machine, but in prison we have the instant coffee. I just need hot water and some instant coffee. There's none of that. They have this coffee machine and I don't know how to work it. Everybody's sleeping and I want coffee. And so just feeling very overwhelmed about that. Those are just the very first day I remembered that. Going to the store for the first time and they have that those self-checkout kiosks.
Yep.
And looking at that, like, whoa, I want to go over there, see how that is. But no, I don't think I want to go over there because I don't know how to work it. I don't want to ask anybody. And just having this weird feeling that everyone knows I just got out of prison, even though there's nobody knowing. Just feeling, they looked at me and just know, they didn't know.
Yeah, that's a horrible feeling. I know that feeling too. It's like you feel like, you know, you look around, you just assume everyone knows, like, and you feel, it's almost like you're like, you feel uncomfortable, like, all the time, you know? So after, you know, you got reacquainted with the outside world, like, what did you set out to do? Like, what was your next step and what was your path?
Well, I mean, before I left prison, like during my time, I always went with like, does this feel right in my gut? Am I being led somewhere? Is the universe opening up an opportunity for me? And if it felt right in my gut, I followed it. So for me, it was like, I always want to do something in alignment with how I see the world now, whether that's treating others with kindness and making some type of impact wherever I go. You know, I used to tell the guys, there was this saying that I said, like, I want to leave seeds of light and love wherever I walk. And out of those seeds of light and love, I would love for flowers to bloom in my wake. And that's how I try to visualize it to myself. This is how I want to show up in the world now. And that was just not knowing what that meant, but just looking at it from that lens and that context. One of my family members had a real estate firm, so I began work right away.
Nice.
And then there's one of these self-help groups that I was involved with called, one of these programs I was involved with in prison called DeFi Ventures, expanded their chapter out down to Southern California where I was living. So I was involved with them in prison, stayed involved with them after I got out. And it's their mission is to shift mindsets to give people with criminal histories their best shot at the second chance through career readiness, personal development, and entrepreneurship training programs. So I was, which, you know, was perfectly in alignment with how I saw things. So I stayed involved with them even after I came home and launched my first company 6 months after. It's a commercial cleaning company with 6 employees. 4 of them are also formerly incarcerated. I still have it. It still runs to this day. But then when they expanded out here and there was an opportunity for me to join the team, I saw this is in alignment with how I want to show up and give back. I joined your team. That was what, 4.5 years ago to help build up the post-release program. And then, of course, my roles and responsibilities continue to evolve and expand. And today I work as the executive director for DeFi Ventures in Southern California.
That's amazing. Wow. You know, to go from all the trauma you've experienced and then being incarcerated with a life sentence and thinking, you know, I'm never going to get out, and then to come out and have such a positive outlook on the world, you know, because you were, you know, all through all those experiences, like you experienced a lot of pain from the outside world, you know, a lot of, you know, racism and all the things that you've been through, and to come out of prison of all places and still have that, you know, positive outlook and wanting to help others is just absolutely admirable. So that's just amazing. And you know, I have heard of DeFi Ventures, and I wish they were here in Pittsburgh because I would love to work with them, but they're not in Pittsburgh. So,
we could connect offline and figure out how we could get them over there. So
that'd be amazing. Yeah. Cause we need it here. I think we have like one organization here that helps incarcerated and formerly incarcerated people. So it's very much needed in our area. But so another question for you, Quan, is just if somebody wanted to connect with you further and, you know, buy your book or meet with you or, you know, just follow you on social media, like how could they find you?
Yeah, I could be found on all social media at Quan X Nguyen. So it's Quan and an X and an Huynh. They could go right to my website also, quanxquin.com. I know that may be hard for people to spell, so I also have sparrowintherazorwire.com pointed at my website. They could go to my website. They could get on my mailing list. If they want to find out about and get involved with the work that we're doing at DeFi Ventures, they could sign up on that list too and partner with me there. So yeah, there's many other ways they could reach out. So on the website or on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, my final question for you, Quan, is what would be your number one tip for our listeners to allow the good things into their lives?
Listen. Listen to the universe. Listen to the gut. Go with your intuition. Ask questions of people. Yeah, just just be open to the possibility of learning from everyone that comes across your path.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Kwan, for your time and for being here and sharing your story. And I will have all your links in the show notes for anyone who wants to connect with you or buy your book. Please buy his book. It's so good. but thank you again, Kwan, for your time.
Okay. Thank you, Amanda.
And just as a reminder for everyone listening, remember, you're stronger than you think, and you can have the life you imagine, regardless of your past. Make sure to hit that follow or subscribe button so you don't miss an episode of the show, and I will talk to you all soon.